So what I'm going to discuss today is work that I did in collaboration with Lionel Mason. It's these two papers. And also, much of this work was inspired by the work of Nimar Khani-Hamed and Freddy Cachazzo and their collaborators. And let me begin just by sort of telling you the punchline of the talk and then going into more detail for the rest of the talk. So what I'm going to consider are on-shell color-ordered scattering amplitudes in the planar limit of n equals 4 super-Yang mills. And these are very interesting to consider because they have remarkable mathematical structure. In particular, they have a lot of hidden symmetry and duality. And in this talk, I'm going to describe a new form of hidden simplicity, which is that the integrands for loop amplitudes can be written in D-log form. And in other words, as exterior derivatives of rational functions. So just to give you an example, which actually is going to be the main example that I focus on this talk, what we found is that the one loop MHV amplitude in n equals 4 super Yang mills in the planar limit can basically be boiled down to this object. And I'll explain what all the notation means later in the talk. But essentially, the I and j, they label external legs of the amplitude. And to get the full one loop amplitude, one sums over all pairs of external legs. And as you can see, the integrand here looks almost trivial. It's just a bunch of D-logs. And so in principle, in particular, it's locally exact. And so in principle, you could do the integral just using Stokes' theorem. But the point is that it's actually not trivial to evaluate because the contours are non-trivial. And the contours are defined by these equations. So in particular, the integration variable S naught and T naught are real, while the integration variables S and T are complex, and they're related by this Mobius transformation. I'll define what these parameters Aij are later in the talk. But essentially, what I want to emphasize here is that these Aijs encode the external data of the amplitude. So in other words, the external data of the amplitude is encoded in the contour of integration. And furthermore, there seems to be a systematic way to do integrals of this form. And it turns out that in order to make this algorithm make sense, one actually is forced to incorporate the Feynman I epsilon prescription. And furthermore, there's a natural way to incorporate massive regularization or the polyvalerse regularization in this approach. And for a generic contribution to the one loop MHV amplitude, we get the following very elegant looking result. It's just a sum of four dialogues and the complex conjugate. Well, the contours weren't closed actually. So for example, this contour is just saying that S naught and T naught are real. Yes. Well, yeah. That's right. That's correct. Sure. Yeah. And this guy says that S and T are just a Mobius transformation. So you can look at these coordinates basically as homogeneous coordinates of a CP1 of a two sphere. So in other words, you can look at a two-sphere, do a stereographic projection into the plane, and then these are coordinates on that plane, yeah. Yes, the answer is yes. Okay, so we find that the generic contribution to the one-loop MHV amplitude has the following very elegant form. And what's interesting about this result actually is that dual conformal invariance is manifest, because as we'll find out later, these parameters can just be expressed in terms of inner products of twisters, of the external twisters of the amplitude. And furthermore, it seems like this method can be readily extended to higher loop amplitudes. So that's basically the punchline of the talk. But now let me go back and give some background and motivation, perhaps. So of course, the first question is why is it interesting to consider amplitudes in n equals 4 super Yang mills theory? Well, I guess the basic answer is that this theory has a tremendous amount of symmetry. And as a result, it's mathematically elegant and it's tractable. So in particular, it has maximal supersymmetry. It's a conformal theory. It's dual to type 2B string theory on ADS5 times S5. So in principle, it's strong coupling. One can do computations as well. And for these reasons, it's believed to be exactly solvable, at least in the planar limit. And on the other hand, at least at tree level, you can truncate the theory to Yang Mills plus other interactions. And so one way of looking at it maybe is as a toy model for QCD. Okay. Now in computing the amplitudes in Yang Mills' theory, it's extremely convenient to decompose null momenta as a product of two spinners. So I should say, of course, this is an on-shell momentum. In other words, it's null, and these are on-shell amplitudes that I'm considering. And essentially what's going on here is that alpha and alpha dot are SU2 indices. They correspond to the two SU2s that the Lorentz group locally corresponds to. So you can think of these as two chiralities of spinners. And it turns out that if you express gluon amplitudes in terms of these spinner variables, the resulting expressions dramatically simplify than if you were to use more conventional variables to parameterize these amplitudes. And I think this is maybe first realized by Park and Taylor. So in particular, in Yang scattering amplitudes in Yang Mills theories, you have what's called an MHV amplitude, which means that two of the external gluons have negative helicity, and the rest have positive helicity. And remarkably, if you express this amplitude using the spinner variables that I showed you on the previous slide, the expression for this amplitude is just this, which is sometimes called the Park-Taylor formula. And so let me explain what the notation means. So these brackets are just inner products of the spinners. And the reason why you have ij appearing in the numerator is that I and j just correspond to the two external legs, which have negative helicity. And furthermore, it turns out that it's possible to actually use these MHV amplitudes as the Feynman vertices to construct non-MHV amplitudes. So for example, what I'm doing here is I'm connecting two MHV amplitudes together. So you can tell that they're MHV because they have two negative helicities each. But in the end, the amplitude as a whole has three negative external helicities. And so this is an NMHV amplitude. And in general, when I speak of an N to the K MHV amplitude, I'm talking about an amplitude with K plus two external gluons with negative helicity. And then, of course, one can generalize these ideas to supersymmetric theory. So in particular, in a supersymmetric theory, one can define something called supermomentum. And this can be decomposed into a spinner and a fermionic variable as follows. So here, A, the index A, it runs from 1 to 4 because I'm considering N equals 4 super Yang Mills, a maximally supersymmetric theory. And then it turns out that in terms of the supermomenta, you can define what's called an MHV superamplitude, which actually encodes the scattering of all species in the theory. So in particular, the gluonic MHV amplitude that I showed you on a previous slide just corresponds to a certain component in the Taylor expansion of this super MHV amplitude. So when I say Taylor expansion, I mean I'm expanding this fermionic delta function in powers of the fermionic variables. And furthermore, I can generalize this MHV amplitude to what's called an N to the K MHV amplitude. And it's convenient to actually pull off a tree-level MHV amplitude as a prefactor. And then for an N to the K MHV amplitude, this remaining factor will have fermionic degree 4K. And in this talk, it's this object that I'm going to primarily focus on. And so one can generalize the CSW formalism to what's called a super CSW formalism, where you just use the super MHV amplitudes as the building blocks, or rather the Feynman vertices to construct non-MHV amplitudes. But you can also use them to construct not just tree-level amplitudes, but loop amplitudes, simply by pasting together two MHV amplitudes in such a way that their lines form a loop. Although I should say this only works for supersymmetric theories. For QCD, this approach won't capture all of the terms. In particular, it doesn't capture what are called rational terms. Okay. Now, so what I've told you is fairly generic, but what I'm going to describe generic to super Yang Mills theories. But what I'm going to describe now is actually special to N equals 4 super Yang Mills theory. So the amplitudes of N equals 4 super Yang Mills theory have a very remarkable property called dual conformal symmetry. And the way to see that is to take the external momenta of your amplitude and arrange them into a closed polygon. And of course, the polygon is going to close just because of momentum conservation. And in this example, I'm focusing on four external particles, but this construction, it works for an arbitrary number of external particles. And then the idea is that you express your amplitude as a function of the vertices of this polygon. Or in other words, you define these dual coordinates such that the difference between two adjacent points is equal to an external momentum. And then the statement of dual conformal invariance really just boils down to the statement that the amplitudes transform covariantly under an inversion in this dual space. So in particular, dual translations are obvious because the amplitudes can of course be expressed in terms of external momenta, but those are just differences of dual coordinates. And so under translations in the dual space, of course, the amplitudes will be invariant. What isn't obvious, though, is that the amplitudes are invariant under these dual inversions. But if they are, or transform covariantly under these dual inversions, but if they are, then you can define a dual conformal boost. And then when you commute that with the dual translations, that gives you the full dual conformal symmetry. And furthermore, you can extend this to a dual superconformal symmetry simply by defining analogous fermionic coordinates in the dual superspace. In other words, coordinates such that when you take the difference of two adjacent ones, that gives you one of the external supermomenta. And this symmetry is not equivalent to the original superconformal symmetry of the theory. And at least if you express n equals 4 super Yang-Mills in space-time, this dual superconformal symmetry is completely hidden from that point of view. So of course, a natural question is, what is the origin of this symmetry? And it turns out that the dual superconformal symmetry actually corresponds to the ordinary superconformal symmetry of the Wilson loop, whose contour is defined by this null polygon. And so really, the origin of this dual superconformal symmetry is a duality between the planar amplitudes and null polygonal Wilson loops in n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. I should say that this is a planar statement, because when one speaks of arranging the external momenta into a polygon, that's well defined only in the planar case. Okay, so right now I've described most of the basic ingredients that one needs in order to prove the D-log form of the loop integrands. But in order to prove it, we actually need only one more ingredient, which is an object called a momentum twister. And momentum twisters are very useful because they make the dual superconformal symmetry of the amplitudes manifest. In particular, they transform in the fundamental representation of the dual superconformal symmetry group. So here, ZA are four bosonic variables. They transform in SU4, which is the conformal group in four dimensions. And chi A are four fermionic variables, and they encode the n equals 4 supersymmetry. And so the bosonic variables typically can be, one can typically splits them into two spinners, lambda and mu alpha dot. And this lambda can be identified with the spinner that I wrote in the decomposition of a null momentum earlier in the talk. But these two spinners are actually not independent. They're related by what are called incidence relations. So here, x alpha dot alpha is a point in the dual space. And the point is that mu and lambda are linearly related in this way. And from this incidence relation, you see furthermore that the momentum twister is a projective object. So in other words, if I rescale lambda and I rescale mu by the same factor, the incidence relation is preserved. And another reason why momentum twisters are very powerful is because they actually make momentum conservation automatic. In other words, if I just hand you a set of momentum twisters, I can actually extract the points in dual space-time from those momentum twisters, and those points will automatically be at the vertices of a null polygonal Wilson loop. So in some sense, momentum conservation is already is built in. So from these incidence relations, one can see that a point in space-time actually corresponds to a complex projective line in twister space. Furthermore, if two lines in twister space intersect, that means that the points in space-time corresponding to these two lines are null separated. And so from that, you can see that a point in twister space actually corresponds to a null ray in space-time. And this correspondence is very useful. In particular, it tells you that a null polygon in space-time will actually correspond to a polygon in twister space, right? Because every vertex of this polygon corresponds to a line in twister space, and every vertex of this polygon corresponds to a null line in space-time. So in other words, these two polygons are exchanged by exchanging the vertices of one with the edges of the other. And so if you combine this with the amplitude Wilson loop duality, what it implies is that one can compute the planar S matrix of n equals 4 superadding mills by actually computing the expectation value of a Wilson loop in twister space. And this is the main tool that I'm going to use, because as it turns out, this D-log form that I'm going to describe, really it comes out very, very simply from the twister Wilson loop. In some sense, the twister Wilson loop hands you the D-log form on a plate. And that's just because it turns out that the Feynman rules for the twister Wilson loop can be written in D-log form. And so anything that you construct out of them is automatically going to have D-log form too. OK, but how do you actually compute the expectation value of the twister Wilson loop? So in order to do that, first you have to define the action of n equals 4 superadding mills in twister space. And then this can be done as follows. So first of all, you can define a superfield, which encodes all of the on-shell degrees of freedom of n equals 4 superadding mills. So in particular, it contains the gluons, the scalars, and the fermions. And then the action for n equals 4 superadding mills basically boils down to this very, very elegant looking object. So let me tell you what the various terms are. So this D3/4z, that's just the measure on twister space, which is actually CP3/4. And so you see, then you have this Chern-Simons term here, which actually corresponds to the self-dual sector of n equals 4 superadding mills. And then this log det term, it turns out, will correspond to an MHV expansion around the self-dual sector. And so the way to see this is to choose an axial gauge. So in other words, we introduce some twister called a reference twister, and we demand that the inner product of the twister with A is equal to 0. And what that does is that eliminates one of the components of A. So then this cubic term vanishes because there are only two independent components. And so it essentially reduces just to this. And then what one does is the following. You see this log det term. You do the following trick. First you factor out the partial bar, and then you have this partial bar inverse A, and then. So in other words, this can equivalently be written as trace of log. And then I can split this into two pieces. So this is trace of log of partial bar plus trace of log of 1 plus partial bar inverse A. OK? And then the trick is to Taylor expand this term. And remarkably, what you find is that every term in this Taylor expansion corresponds to an MHV amplitude. So another way to put it is that the Feynman rules of the twister action for n equals 4 superadding mills are simply the CSW formalism that I described to you on an earlier slide. So in particular, you can obtain the propagator simply by inverting this d bar over here. And that turns out just to be a projective delta function. So the propagator between two points in twister space simply imposes that they lie on a line that intersects with the reference twister. And furthermore, from Taylor expanding the log det term, you get terms of the following form. And so let me explain to you what this means. Let's see. So first of all, you see this integration here of ZA and ZB. What that corresponds to is integrating over all the points of space-time. Because remember that a point in space-time corresponds to a line in twister space, which can be parameterized by two points. However, there's this vol GL2 here, which simply expresses the fact that if I were just to integrate over ZA and ZB, not all of these points would pairs of points would define different lines. There's some redundancy in how one defines this line, these lines, and so one divides by this by the volume of GL2 to eliminate this redundancy. Now this factor over here, the picture I have in mind is the following. So remember that a point in space-time, it corresponds to a line in twister space. So ZA and ZB, they're the guys that define this line. And then the picture I have in mind is that I'm attaching propagators to this line. And so I label the propagators 1 to n. And so sigma I are just the homogeneous coordinates along this line associated with the ith propagator. So in other words, one end of the propagator is going to end on this line. And then I parameterize the location of that endpoint using these homogeneous coordinates sigma. And then sigma I, sigma j here is just defined in the following way. But this should actually look familiar to you. Actually, this is exactly the same structure we saw in the MHV superamplitude. This is just the Park-Taylor denominator. And in fact, this is the MHV superamplitude in disguise, which is why these vertices, these interaction vertices, are referred to as MHV vertices. So actually, these are all the building blocks we need to compute Wilson loop diagrams. And yeah, I guess the only thing that remains is okay. Well, let me just give you a little bit more detail about how the twister Wilson loop is defined. So given that action that I just described, you simply exponentiate it, and then you compute the expectation value of the Wilson loop, where roughly speaking, one can define the Wilson loop W as follows. So you take, for a given edge of the Wilson loop spanned by the twister ZI and ZI minus 1 and ZI, one simply solves this equation for HI. So in some sense, it just corresponds to parallel transport. And then for each of the edge of the Wilson loop, one takes the product of these HIs, and one takes the trace. And so these are the building blocks one needs to compute the expectation value of the Wilson loop. But I claimed earlier, of course, that this is actually, in the end, going to compute for you a planar scattering amplitude. So the question is, how do you map back and forth between the two objects? And it's very easy. So the way you do so is as follows. So the number of legs of an amplitude will just correspond to the number of sides in the Wilson loop. The number of loops in the amplitude will correspond to the number of MHV vertices that appear in your Wilson loop diagram. And finally, the MHV degree of the amplitude will correspond to the number of propagators minus twice the number of MHV vertices. And these are the rules that you need to map back and forth between amplitudes and Wilson loops, or at least amplitude diagrams and Wilson loop diagrams. So let me give you some examples. So this is the CSW diagram for an NMHV amplitude. Remember, I showed you that on a slide earlier. It's made just by gluing together two MHV amplitudes. But the corresponding Wilson loop diagram just corresponds to a propagator between two edges of the Wilson loop. So you can tell that this corresponds to a tree-level NMHV amplitude because, first of all, there are no MHV vertices here, so the loop level is zero. Second of all, there's one propagator, and so we see that the number of propagators minus the number of NHV vertices is just one, and so that corresponds to the MHV degree, and so that's quite straightforward. And just to give you another example, a loop example, which is what I'm going to focus on in the rest of the talk, this is the CSW diagram for a one-loop amplitude, which I showed you before, simply by pasting together two MHV amplitudes in such a way that their legs form a loop. And the Wilson loop diagram that corresponds to this contains one MHV vertex and two propagators. And then, of course, you get the full one-loop MHV amplitude by summing over all the pairs of external edges that are connected by these propagators. Okay, and so you can tell that this is a one-loop MHV amplitude because, again, you have one MHV vertex that tells you it's one loop. And the number of propagators is 2 minus twice the number of MHV vertices is 2. That's 0, and so the MHV degree is, in fact, 0. Okay, so let me be a little bit more concrete. and show you explicitly how such a computation would be done. Also to emphasize the simplicity of this method. So this is the one loop, this is the twister Wilson loop diagram, which corresponds to a one loop MHV amplitude. Okay, so remember from the Feynman rules, since we have two propagators, we're going to have two delta functions. Since we have one MHV vertex, there's an integral over ZA and ZB. Okay. Now, you see this combination ZI minus 1 and ZI appearing here. Well, that just tells you that this propagator ends on this line, which is defined by the two points ZI minus 1 and ZI. So the point is that the endpoint of this propagator lies somewhere on this line, and it's parameterized. The location is parameterized by S1 and T1, which are sort of the homogeneous coordinates associated with the projective line, which corresponds to this edge. Similarly, you see the appearance of ZJ minus 1 and ZJ. And again, that's just telling you that the endpoint of this propagator is on this line. Okay. The only thing that might be slightly puzzling here is why you don't see both ZA and ZB here, right? So in this propagator, you see just ZA. And in this propagator, you just see ZB. But of course, you know, if these propagators are attached to this line, you would expect both ZA and ZB to appear. The reason why they don't is because I fixed the GL2 gauge symmetry. So in other words, before fixing the GL2 gauge symmetry, in general, the endpoint of the propagator would be some linear combination of ZA and ZB. But I fixed the GL2 gauge symmetry so as to set sigma 1 equal to 0 here and sigma 0 equal to 0 there. So I've already, so the point is that this expression was obtained already with the GL2 gauge fixing. Okay. So you might notice that this ZA and ZB integral are trivial to do. You're just integrating against delta functions. And really all they do is enforce that ZA is equal to this and ZB is equal to this. And after performing the ZA and ZB the ZA and ZB integrals, we're just left with 4 D logs, as I promised you. Okay. However, there are some additional constraints that one should impose, and these constraints come from the fact that this MHV vertex corresponds to a point in the dual space, and that point in the dual space more or less corresponds to the loop momentum. So when we're integrating over ZA and ZB, we're actually integrating over the loop momentum in the amplitude. But this loop momentum, it lies in real Minkowski space. So in order to enforce that, we have to impose certain reality conditions, just the following reality conditions, that ZA dot ZA bar is equal to ZB dot ZB bar is equal to ZA dot ZB bar is equal to 0. And this will actually enforce that the point in dual space is real. And that's very easy to see. It just comes directly from the incidence relations. So if you plug in the incidence relations that I showed you on an earlier slide, you see that these conditions are equivalent to saying that the point in the dual space is real. So before I see what these equations imply, first I want to do the following change of variables. So I'm going to redefine S1 and T1, S2 and T2 in the following way, and you'll see why in a second. So after I make these replacements and then I plug ZA and ZB into these equations, that will actually define the contour of integration. So in particular, what we find is that ZA dot ZA bar implies that one of the variables S0 is real. ZB dot ZB bar implies that another variable T0 is real. And finally, ZA dot ZB bar is equal to 0 tells you that S and T variables are complex, but they're related by a Möbius transformation, where here this variable V is equal to S0 minus T0. So V is just some real variable. And these parameters, AIJs, they just correspond to inner products of the external twisters. So in this way, the external data of the amplitude is encoded. But the point is that the contour of integration is just coming from imposing reality constraints at every MHV vertex. Okay. So let me summarize what we've discussed so far. So first of all, what I tried to argue is that the D-log form of loop integrands, it comes directly from the twister Wilson loop. And I've shown you the example of a one loop MHV amplitude explicitly, but this story generalizes. And it doesn't get much more complicated at the level of the integrand. So in general, for an L loop n to the k MHV amplitude, what you'll find is that the integrand you obtain using this method has 4L plus k d logs and k delta functions. So in particular, if you set k, which is the MHV degree, to 0, brings you into the MHV sector. And so you see that an L loop MHV amplitude will have 4L d logs. And furthermore, one can define the contour of integration. Before I say that, I just want to say that these d logs, they have a very simple and elegant geometrical interpretation. They just correspond to insertion points of propagators on edges or MHV vertices. And from this interpretation, you can easily derive the integration contour simply by imposing reality constraints at every MHV vertex. So let me just point out that there's another way to obtain a D-log form. And this was obtained by Arkani Hamed, Borgeli, Cacciazzo, Gontroff, Posnikoff, and Turnka. And this approach on the surface, it seems very different than the twister-Wilson loop approach. So in this approach, what they use are what are called on-shell diagrams. So there are no virtual particles. These black and white dots, they correspond to MHV, three-point MHV, or anti-MHV vertices. And actually, what this diagram corresponds to is the one-loop MHV amplitude with four external particles. And so in their approach, these D-log variables, they actually correspond to BCFW shifts. So in particular, from this diagram, So this object here is called a BCFW bridge. And this introduces a D-log variable. And since you have four of these BCFW bridges, you can see that you're again going to have four D logs. But their interpretation is quite different. Whereas the D log integration variables correspond to insertion points of propagators on edges or MHV vertices in our case, in their case, they correspond to BCFW shifts. Sorry, did you have a question?
Can you elaborate why the number of legs that are attached to edges of the polygon just go linearly with the loop? Because the pair loop, I would expect maybe just two legs on the edges, but no structure inside.
Sorry, the question is why the number of legs goes linearly with the loops. I mean, this is just a four-point example.
About the previous slide, about your structure. Why 10 loops, there's some diagrams with only two legs?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. So, okay. In the Twister-Wilson loop approach, it goes linearly with the number of MHV vertices, not the number of external legs.
The number of D-logs you had was the number of loops, or can it be less?
Four times the number of loops, yes. And it's the same in their approach, I believe, at least at MHV.
Haven't you said that each D-log corresponds to the integration along the edge?
That's right. Let me see what the best way to explain this is. It corresponds to integration over an edge, but it corresponds to integration over a pair of edges. So in other words, for one loop, you're connecting. So for one loop, you have one MHV vertex, right? And then you have a propagator, and then you have two propagators coming out of it, and these will connect two edges, right? And so you have a pair of integration variables associated with each of these edges. So that's why you have four. Now for higher loops, you're going to have more MHV vertices. And so that means that it's going to involve more pairs of edges. So for example, at two loops, let me show you. What's that? No. I mean, they don't intersect in general. They're just sort of lines in twister space, and they don't. I see what you mean. OK, sorry. That's right. So maybe another example. Let's say three loops. Something like that, perhaps. So this is another, oh, two legs at two edges, very good. So you might ask, okay, well, what's wrong with this? This vanishes. So in fact, it turns out that for the non-vanishing diagrams, one can show that one has to be able to attach two propagators to each MHV vertex. If it's not possible, then it's going to vanish. So if I remove this guy, it's not possible to assign two different legs to every MHV amplitude to every MHV vertex. Why? Let's look at this guy. Well, this guy only has two propagators attached to it, so I can't use these anymore. Okay? But now I can choose these two propagators to attach to this MHV vertex, but once I do that, there's only one propagator left. So there is this general statement, a non-trivial statement, that amplitudes for which it's not possible to attach two propagators to MHV to every MHV vertex and just to that MHV vertex, those amplitudes will vanish. So the number of that's right for MHV, yeah, it's 4L, yeah.
4L and not less.
Correct. Yeah, but for non-MHV amplitudes, it's 4L plus K, 4L, 4L, 4 times L plus K. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah, I didn't touch upon that point because I thought it would be a little bit confusing, but it's good that you asked. Okay, so now in the remaining time, let me describe for you a systematic method for evaluating integrals of this form. So this is, as we saw, a generic diagram which contributes to the one loop MHV amplitude. Okay, but as we saw, the reality constraints that the MHV vertex impose at S0 and T0 are real. And of course, that's a problem because you have these are poles on the real axis, and so they need to be regulated. But it turns out that there's a natural way to regulate them, and that's via the I epsilon prescription. It turns out actually that these real variables, they just correspond to the two propagators. In the MHV diagram. And so by doing the I epsilon prescription in these two propagators, that's actually going to translate into a shift on S0 and T0 into the complex plane. So let me describe that to you in a little bit more detail. So here's the CSW diagram that corresponds to the Wilson loop diagram we were looking at. And it turns out that S0 is related to this propagator, and T0 is related to this propagator. The way to see that is simply to express the momentum flowing through this propagator. It's just x minus xi squared. Then I can write that in terms of twisters using the standard formula from twister theory. And then remember that we had these constraints from integrating against the delta functions that told us that just forced ZA and ZB to be some linear combination of the external twisters. So we just plug in those constraints, and then what you find is that x minus xi squared is proportional to S0 times some function fi, which is just a function of t bar and v. So the point is that x minus xi squared is proportional to S0, and x minus xj is proportional to T0. And so when we do the I epsilon prescription by shifting x minus xi squared to xi minus xi squared plus epsilon, that corresponds to shifting S0. By I epsilon times this function of the other integration variables. And so this, yes?
Just the way that divergences come out in the D-log form is that the contour of integration gets pinched between the branch cuts of the logs.
That's right. Yeah, I'll get to that in the end. Yeah, you're right. So in our case, okay, well, you're making me skip ahead a little, but that's maybe not a bad thing. Point is, what I'm describing so far is a generic diagram where the propagators attach, you know, two edges that aren't adjacent. So it turns out that these diagrams are finite, generically, but then you have these divergent ones when the propagator attaches two adjacent edges. So that those are the ones that need to be regulated. The integral that I'm going to describe for you now is for the generic case, when the two edges are not adjacent. Okay, so the point is that by doing this I epsilon prescription, that allows us to make the S naught and T naught integrals well defined. And furthermore, it turns out that the linear combination S naught plus T naught doesn't appear anywhere else in the integral. So we can just go ahead and do it. It's just no trouble at all. Why? Because S, remember we had these reality constraints, and it said that S was related to T bar via some Mobius transformation. But the linear combination S naught plus T naught doesn't appear in that reality constraint. And so we can just go ahead and shift S naught and T naught by I epsilon and integrate out S naught plus T naught. And what that gives us is the following somewhat complicated looking function, where V is just linear combination S naught minus T naught. And I write here that S is a function of V and T bar via this reality constraint. But notice that S naught and T naught don't appear in this. Now at first sight, this looks kind of scary. And it also looks like it's not dual conformal invariant, because Fi and Fj, they're coming from these equations here. And these equations, they involve these two brackets, which involve what's called the infinity twister. In any case, these two brackets break dual conformal symmetry that I mentioned before. So you see Fi and Fj appearing here, and you know that they depend on the infinity twister and that they break dual conformal symmetry. So you say to yourself, surely dual conformal symmetry has been broken by the I epsilon prescription. But what was surprising, and I think kind of remarkable, and sort of reflects the naturalness of this approach, is that somehow these terms conspire to preserve dual conformal symmetry. It turns out, actually, that on the support, so this is the theta function. In other words, it's 0 when negative ifj is less than 0, and it's 1 when negative fifj is greater than 0. So it turns out that on the support of this theta function, the sine of fj is constant. So we can just throw it out. And furthermore, if one looks at fi and fj, one writes it out explicitly in terms of v and t bar, what you find is that this actually just restricts, just puts a restriction on the v integral. In particular, it tells you that the v integral doesn't contain the origin. So in that case, this epsilon fi minus fj can just be neglected, because that only kicks in when v is 0. And it restricts the integral to two possibilities, the integral over v to two possibilities. What you find is that one possibility is from the value v equals v star goes to infinity, or the other possibility is negative infinity to v star. And in this case, this is when v star is greater than 0, because remember, the integration contour does not include the origin. In this case, it's when v star is less than 0. And v star actually just can be expressed very nicely in terms of these the external data like this. And it can be furthermore expressed in terms of in this twistorial notation like this. And so what we see is that actually, in the end, the I epsilon prescription doesn't break dual conformal invariants, because everything is just written in terms of inner products of twisters. And since the twisters make dual conformal invariants manifest, that means that the dual conformal invariance is preserved up to the choice of reference twister, Z star. And so for definiteness, let's just choose the case where V star is greater than 0. So let's just focus on this. This case is pretty much identical up to a sine. OK, so good. So now we're just left with an integral over V. And we're left over with this integral over T and S. But it turns out that this integral can straightforwardly be done using Stokes' theorem. So what I mean by that is the following. So I have an integral like this, d log t, d log s. So I can just write this as d of log t, d log s. And then I'm going to have a branch cut in t from this log, and I'm going to have poles in t bar coming from the log s, the d log s, because remember, we can express s in terms of t bar using that reality constraint. So it's completely straightforward to do. It's just a contour integral around a branch cut and four poles. And in the end, the answer one obtains is the following. It's just this answer in terms of v. But now I can just plug that back into my original integral and do the v integral, right? So essentially, I've done this, and now all I'm left with is this v integral, and that can also be done explicitly. And what you find is a generically finite answer. Very, very, I think, simple and elegant looking answer, which is also real, manifestly real, because we're adding the complex conjugate, because we have this absolute value here, in terms of v star and the aij. And I should say that this formula only makes sense in the case where the propagator does not attach two adjacent edges. If it does attach two adjacent edges, v star will go to zero, and so things will blow up, and so you need to regulate it. But at least for generic diagrams which don't attach adjacent edges, they're described by this formula. And so you can get the generic contribution simply by summing over all the I and J, which are not adjacent. So this formula is simple, as I said. But it's also tells us something that wasn't known before, which is that the generic contribution to the one-loop MHV amplitude preserves dual conformal invariance up to the choice of this reference twister. And furthermore, it does agree with previous results. So we did do some manipulations and match it with the result of Brand, well, with the result that computed the one-loop MHV amplitude using the CSW formalism. Okay, but of course now, yes, sorry.
Does this integral, does the L plus one loop order look like the L loop order?
Very good question. Very good question. Yeah, I'm going to address that in a few slides. That's going to be the second to last slide of the talk. Yeah, in some sense, you can think of the one loop, the Kermit diagram, as being a building block for higher loop diagrams. But it's not completely trivial. But I'll try to address this a little bit in two slides. So now let's talk about the case where this propagator attaches two adjacent edges. In our setup, there's a very natural way to regulate this diagram. One simply takes the I epsilon to an M squared, and then it corresponds to a massive regulator. And in fact, after doing that, you obtain the following integral, which is now somewhat complicated function, not easy to integrate. But in the limit that M goes to zero, at least we verified that one gets the standard log squared of M behavior that was obtained using other methods, for example, going to the Coulomb branch of n equals 4 superangles. Although we're still trying to fix the finite piece, so that hasn't been completely calculated yet. Now let me talk about higher loops. And as an example, let me talk about the two-loop MHV diagram. So in this case, there are really only two topologies of diagrams you can have. One where you have two propagators, and then another one where you have an MHV vertex with three propagators attached to it. Now, this case is essentially just the square of the one-loop amplitude. It's not completely trivial because there is the case, there is the following case. Where the propagators end on the same edge. So this case is not just the square of the one loop. But what you can do is just take the one loop answer, and then one takes the other propagator, this point on the other propagator, sort of as the endpoint of integration here. And in doing so, that'll just give you the two-loop answer. And so it turns out that for this case where they don't end on the same edge, this is just di log squared. In this case, you'll get quad logs. And then this case is the most non-trivial. And what? Well, yeah, I mean one has to consider cases where they don't, I mean, where it's a planar Wilson loop. So in this case, it's actually the least trivial, but this is what we're looking at now. And in principle, at seven, for seven external legs and higher, you're going to get other types of functions, not just classical polylogs, but more interesting functions as well, at least other functions as well. But this we haven't looked at yet, or at least we haven't completely worked out yet. We're in the process of looking at it. But the point is that actually the story that we saw at one loop, it generalizes in certain ways. So in general, for an MHV amplitude, as I said, we're going to have four LD logs. And the reality constraints are going to impose that half of them are real. And that just means that they correspond to to physical propagators. And so we can regulate them using the Feynman I epsilon prescription as we did before. And the other ones are going to be complex. And for those, one can just use Stokes' theorem as we did before. And I think at this point, I'll just tell you my conclusions. So to summarize what I got, this is the basic message of the talk. First of all, there seems to be some remarkable and useful new form of simplicity in the planar amplitudes of n equals 4 superangles, which is that there is a way to write the integrands in D-log form. In fact, there are two alternative approaches for doing this. One of them uses the Twister-Wilson loop. Another one uses on-shell diagrams. And in the Twister-Wilson loop, in fact, the D-log form follows very, very simply because the Feynman rules for the Twister-Wilson loop can essentially be written in a D-log form. And furthermore, it gives you a very elegant and simple interpretation for what the D-log form corresponds to. As I said, it corresponds to insertion points of propagators on MHV vertices or on edges of the Wilson loop. And furthermore, at least for the Twister-Wilson loop, we have a systematic method for doing these D-log integrals, at least for one loop MHV. I think it can be extended to higher loops, but more work still needs to be done. And at least for one loop MHV, we got a very elegant answer that's manifestly dual conformal invariant up to a choice of a certain reference twister. And there are several natural directions. I mean, of course, one thing to do is to complete the two-loop computation and try to reproduce some of the results that people have obtained using other methods. For example, see the appearance of non-classical polylogs or the appearance of cluster coordinates that were recently discovered for two-loop MHV amplitudes. Of course, a very interesting question is how this relates to the D-log form that you obtain using the on-shell diagram approach. As I said, on the surface, they look quite distinct. And also, if the method that I described for doing these integrals can be applied to integrals obtained using the on-shell diagram approach. And of course, another natural direction is to see whether these methods can be used for other theories, other than n equals 4 superangmills. And the hope is that this is somewhat generic. And actually, one of the interesting things about the on-shell diagram approach is that in principle, it seems more clear how to extend it to other theories. In particular, I think for n less than 4 or n greater than or equal to 1, there is some sort of on-shell diagram formalism. And I think also one has been proposed for the ABJM theory. So it's conceivable that these methods can be extended to other theories. And then finally, another question to ask is, what about the non-planar sector? I mean, of course, I was just considering planar Wilson loop diagrams, and one can just consider planar on-shell diagrams, but nothing prevents you from trying to compute non-planar ones. Of course, their relation to scattering amplitudes isn't completely clear, but I mean, they exist and they can be computed, and so it would be interesting to see what that gives you. So I think I'll end there. Thank you.
So even at one loop, when you say that you want to write the integrated form and you write it in terms of dialogues and so on, I mean, really, dialogues are integrals. I mean, they are twofold integrals. So when people talk about integrating, finding the integrated answer, they don't really mean that there is an integrated answer.
That's true.
They mean writing things in terms of functions that are
iterated into
two-fold integers.
Right.
Because that's a correct transcendentality, right? So I would declare victory the moment you can write something, never mind the name of the functions, but the moment you can write something with only 2L integrals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're pretty close to that, right? I mean, the moment mm-hmm. you can show that at L loops, you can reduce from 4L integrals to 2L integrals,
yeah.
then you're basically done.
I see. Yeah, I
mean, then you can call those your
I can just define those as
functions. Like,
Lipstein functions.
I mean,
yeah.
who cares if they are Goncharov, polylogs?
Right.
This is not important, I think.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess one could take that point of view, sure.
So and I think you're very close to that, right? I mean, this
yeah.
separation of the real contour with the other ones that can
that's
be
right.
done using Stokes, it's
right.
hinting that there is really a way to just go down to the correct transcendentality and then be done.
That's
so
right.
everything else is just I think it's irrelevant.
Yeah, that's I think a very interesting point of view. Yeah, I guess a lot of results in the literature have focused on dialogues or polylogs and so forth, and or other types of functions. And we wanted to maybe it might be interesting to make contact with that too. But of course, as you point out, these are just all different ways of representing the same thing. And so they're just, yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. An interesting point.
Any other questions? If not, let's think after a bit.